This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with General Russell Honoré, the man who brought Louisiana back from the brink after Hurricane Katrina, still active in American life, and he has some thoughts about what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri. General Russell Honoré also is leading the Green Army in Louisiana. We will talk with him about how that's going as well. Also, Gwen Roland, the author of the book Atchafalaya Houseboat and the star of the award-winning LPB documentary of the same name, she's in town. We will talk with her about her endeavor, something that has captured the fancy of people around the country. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show, Frank Barnett producing, and General Russell Honoré is with us to talk about a few different matters, and we certainly invite your input as we visit with the General, one of our favorite guests, and the gentleman who led Louisiana back from the brink in 2005 after Katrina. We're coming up on 9 years. Hard to believe, isn't it?
Absolutely. Next week.
Next week. 9 years since you were dispatched to New Orleans, and that was quite a scene.
It was, and as we speak, there's a hurricane in the Gulf. So beware.
Well, it is that time of the year.
It's that time of the year. They're going to come. And hopefully, from what I heard this morning on the weather, you know, they're still working on it, whether it'll make it into the Gulf, but there's a probability it will. And now is the time to prepare that. Remember, Katrina, 9 years next Friday, came in, hit New Orleans. So we got time to get ready. Keep your eye on it.
Well, the big hurricanes that have hit Louisiana in the last half century have been in the last week of August or first week of September. That includes Katrina and Andrew and Camille and Betsy. And General Russell Honoré has been through all of those. And he spent 7 years, 3 months, and 3 days in the United States Army at the highest levels, and he was dispatched to New Orleans and became a worldwide phenomenon. He's written about his life and times in his book, Leadership in the New Normal. Certainly applies to what's going on right now in Ferguson, Missouri. What is going on there?
Well, I've spent the first few days of, or last few days of last week, asking to give comment on what I saw the police doing. And has led into some more, what do you think it takes to stop the violence? And I try to describe to people that having spent a good bit of my career always being prepared, because that's one of the missions we have in the Army, is to be able to deal with civil disturbance. It's not a primary mission, but we have a book about this thick on it. From my experience coming out of the 60s and things that happened to us overseas. And the most recent experience I had in 2000 in Korea, when we had 100,000 people trying to get into my camps because we had had an accident, an incident happened, and they wanted to come out and express their First Amendment right to assemble. And then assembly went from assembling to civil disobedience. So that gave me a fresh appreciation that inside a democracy, people want to express to assemble. The problem is when they go to civil disobedience. And so people say, well, what are the police doing wrong? I said, well, one of the things, the police are playing into the narrative of the demonstrators. When the police respond to the demonstrators for what sometime appear to be normal demonstration type appearance, like throwing a water bottle or pushing trying to get through the police line, that's normal when you deal with a demonstrator. But if your response is SWAT team, you ought not be pointing guns at American citizens. This is just unbelievable. Many of them with children standing next to them. So that's how I got into a broader narrative. But as far as the legal aspects, I don't track that. I've been tracking primarily the police response and how they deal with a civil disturbance. And I'm disturbed by what I see.
We had a lot of this in the 60s.
Yes.
And got a lot of experience on how to curb riots. Of course, there was a riot that enveloped Baton Rouge in the early 1970s, ripped this city apart. Similar to what's going on right now in Ferguson, Missouri. How can you prepare for something like this?
Well, the police have to train. First, recognize that it can happen anytime. So that means you have to train. And normally, a single police department isn't good enough or big enough to deal with a significant civil disturbance in a town like the size of Baton Rouge. So they have to collaborate with state police as well as with mutual agreements from other parishes. And the way things are today, Jim, not a lot of that training is happening. A lot of emphasis on our police have been placed on the active shooter because those things make television, and all of them have, well, not all of them, but many of them have properly armed themselves to deal with an active shooter scenario. And those do happen, and thank God our police are there to deal with them. But in the terms of civil disturbance, we have lost the art. I went back on television, on the computer the other night and looked at Korean police response to civil disturbance or to riots. And if you hadn't done it, just go take a look. I mean, they practice this all the time because they have a lot more demonstrations than we have. Or go take a look at the London police take a guy down with a knife in his hand. They don't carry weapons.
They don't carry weapons.
Right. And they take a guy down with a knife in his hand. What do we do here in America? So I do think we need to retrain our police and better equip them to deal with people and use the least force possible. Mm-hmm. Now, that I get a lot of static on Twitter and other places saying, hey, you know, the police got to defend themselves. In a public demonstration, when people are being civil disobedient, something like a water bottle is their defiance of the government. Do you shoot them over it? Do you put tear gas on them? I mean, this is the issue of the day on how we're going to deal with this in the future.
There's that classic scene in Katrina where you knock down a gun from a soldier. Guns should be the last option, right?
Right. Anytime you point a gun at civilians, you need to go through retraining, unless you intend to use it or you're in the process of using it. We do not use guns as a part of our culture to terminate people. I don't know where that came from. I don't think these police probably watching too much television, but you don't use guns to control people as far as pushing them back. And as far as civil disturbance, using a SWAT team to on the front line of a demonstration is not a solution. Even the uniform these police continue to wear are not ones that are reminiscent of current doctrine or capacity to deal with demonstrators. They're not equipped. They're not trained, but they are trained for what I look like. They look like they're well-trained for an active shooter and an assault team.
297-5633, your number for General Russell Honore, who was the hero of Katrina, who has some biting comments about what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, as far as controlling these riots that have erupted after the death of Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, 18 years old, who was killed by a white police officer. 877-217-5757. Ferguson, Missouri, I checked last census count, 21,111 people. About one-fifth the size of Tiger Stadium. And now the eyes of the world are on this city in suburban St. Louis. It is amazing how an unknown hamlet can suddenly become the focal point of the entire world. What do you think about the frustrations that are obviously at play with the people who are rioting, some of whom I'm sure are taking advantage of this situation, but others who legitimately feel disenfranchised in our country? What's going on with America at large?
Well, it goes to show. I mean, we had an incident up in Jenner, Louisiana a few years ago. I think it goes to show that in the new normal, what would have been a minor incident 20 years ago, it can be a strategic event today. Something that might have gone unnoticed can be on the global stage in a matter of hours. And I think that is what has happened in Jenna, and that police in their actions need to catch up with the 21st century. If they do something, they can expect to see it again. That all this creates a dynamic, Jim, into that narrative when that people that are demonstrating and said the police have not been fair to us. We don't often get a fair shake in justice system. And the police are too aggressive when they respond to the demonstrators. Yet what we saw the following days was more police, more aggressive behavior, and no one standing up on the political side to say, this is how we're going to address your concern, knowing well that justice will be done in court. It's not going to be done on the street. We will not allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. The justice will happen in a court of law. And if you don't like the government you got, you go to the ballot box. That's how you change that. But the politicians have to come out and talk to the people and give them voice and let them understand. People are frustrated, particularly when they bring the scene up of that kid laying on the ground that long. And particularly when we go 2 days ago, another young man shot by police with a knife in his hand. And that is starting to break up a pattern here that is too often seen around America, where people are getting shot and killed by police. Now, the other part of that narrative is people shoot and kill themselves in and around the community. So that's a complicated situation. I don't quite understand it all, but I do understand police response to civil disturbance.
297-5633, your number for General Russell Honoré, who has some experience in controlling crowds, and it goes beyond Katrina. But obviously that situation in the Superdome, it was ripe for all kinds of problems, many of which occurred before you got there. But what are some of the basics as far as entering into a situation like this?
Open the line of communications up and embrace the people that you're there for them, because at the end of the day, the military and the police have one function. That's to protect the people, protect and serve the people, and to deal with those that pose a threat to the rest of the population. But you have to embrace the people that you're there to protect. I mean, you can't treat them like aliens. You have to treat them with respect, and you have to embrace them. And in doing that, you got to talk to them. You got to speak to them. Mm-hmm. Good morning. You know, just a simple engagement with people. What's going on here? Learn to ask the open question, and people will tell you. But if you get out your car and you got your hand on your gun because you see four or five people standing there, what message are you sending? I mean, so I think we need to do some more retraining in that regard in understanding the purpose of our service, whether you're in the Army or any one of the services, or you're in the police department.
Linda on college. Good morning, Linda. You're on WRKF.
Hello?
Yes. Do I have the right Frank? Okay. Linda, good morning. You're on WRKF. Yes.
I think General Honoré is exactly right. The police need major, major retraining. That the first response is not supposed to be to pull out a gun. I mean, I just think, I mean, even when you watch these cop shows, okay, the only time they use their guns is if they have been shot at.
297-5633. We'll get the general's response and hear from some other folks who are waiting in line. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Back in 90 seconds with General Russell Honoré. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 for General Russell Honore, Roy and Zachary. Good morning, Roy. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you, General Honore, for being on the program. I had read that this town is like two-thirds minority and that they only had three minority policemen on the force. Do you think this contributes to the problem?
From what you're hearing and watching on television, everybody's attributed that is lacking in the town. They don't have the demographics of the police department should represent of the people that they serve or as close as one can. And many experts have spoken to that. And everyone that's come on that's talked about that have raised an eyebrow that maybe they need to do something different and do some more recruiting and help build a police force to reflect the population.
Thank you, Roy. Kim on Segan. Good morning. You're on with General Honore. Hi, Kim. Is that Kim?
Yes. I want to ask the general a question. I've heard him speak about the police and everybody, but I've never heard him speak about the responsibility of citizens not to loot, burn, and tear up. And I went through the 60s in the military, and I was sent to Forest City, Arkansas, and Sweet Willie Wine was going to burn the city of Forest City to march into Mississippi. And I just want to know what's the responsibility of citizens to behave themselves in adverse conditions from the general.
Thank you.
You can't
Jim,
break the law.
That's Jim, by the way.
Yeah, Jim, you can't hurt people. You've got the right to protest. You do not have the right to destroy or people property or to hurt anybody. And when you do that, you break the law. And you're going to be dealt with accordingly. So the responsibility of citizens is to not break the law. I'm not an advocate of people breaking the law, even in protests. Trust me. I've been on the receiving end of people throwing things, eggs and bricks and everything else. But we hold our fire. We don't shoot people as a result of that. So as far as people following the law, yeah, I do think people need to follow the law.
Rinaldi in Sherwood. Rinaldi, good morning. You're on with General Honore. Hi, Rinaldi. Frank, can you pot up the caller? All right, Rinaldi, are you on?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, General, thank you for your service to the country and being a loyal Southernite. And just along those lines, if there's an opening for the presidency at Southern, would you consider it if you're asked?
No.
And that's my question.
Thank you.
No, you're not interested in becoming a leader of academia?
No, that's not my skill set. I mean, it takes people a long time to move to that. But no, I would not be interested. But I thank you, and it's an honor that you've asked. But thanks for asking.
There is qualifying going on for several offices right now. Are you going to show up at the Secretary of State's office between now and 5 o'clock tomorrow?
No.
No? No? Next year, maybe?
No.
No? Not going to run for governor?
As far as I know, no.
As far as you know. Well, there are those who would say you would be a good governor, and you obviously have leadership abilities. And what happens when you're in charge and one of your people goes off and does something like you just said, points a gun at somebody? What do you do in a case like that?
Take them into retraining. And if it broke a law, then deal with them accordingly. And you know, I had several hundred police work for me inside my formation as a division commander, and they can break the law too. And we've got to hold our formations accountable. And in this case, I'm not anti-police. I come here under the umbrella that the police are keeping this town and its streets safe and keeping us secure. It's what we have seen played out in the last couple of days in terms of civil disturbance is a problem.
297-5633, your number. Nicholas on Nicholson says, when there is a crowd of angry people facing the police, how do you choose from this crowd whom to open a line of communication with?
Well, if it's gotten to that point, you have to have the right training with your police force. You have to have the right equipment, and that's the 5-foot shields with the hood cover, with arm protection for your police, so if somebody throws something, I have yet to see these police come out in a doctrinally current 21st century riot or demonstration uniform. They're standing out there with their hats off. They're standing out there in short sleeve. You do not go to control a demonstration dressed in an assault uniform. So I think we got to get retraining. It has to be done. And it's hard to solve it when somebody have decided to do civil disobedience, which is to rush the police, throw things at them. That relationship has to be built before the demonstration. And then police have to be integrated in the demonstration. They're setting the line up over here and inviting them to come to you. You got to have police in and around integrated in the formation. And you've got to have a good number of police undercover in that formation as they move.
All right. 297-5633 is your number. And General Russell Honoré is here for a bit longer, and we will talk with him about some other matters as well. The hero of Katrina, 9 years ago in 8 days, a week from tomorrow. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on with General Honoré.
Good morning, gentlemen, and I want to thank you, sir, as well. I think you're a wonderful citizen and a role model for us. My question is this, though. We're living in a, like 200 million guns out there in the United States. When I get stopped for a traffic violation or get pulled over, the police come up as if I'm armed. And all our citizens have to live down to that standard. And then in Florida, there's the right to shoot someone you're afraid of, which is the stand your ground law. So as far as where justice, peace, and violence do you think the guns? I'd hate to be a policeman, by the way, for all the guns that are out there. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think with the number of guns out there, police in many cases are justified in moving with caution. I think they are justified because the guns are prolific on the streets. And probably as a result of Ferguson, we're going to have more guns.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that situation, we've got to solve that in the ballot box. People will have to come to grips. I spent 9.5 years overseas, walking the streets everywhere from Istanbul to Kuwait, to Seoul, South Korea, London, Paris, Mons, Liège, all over Germany. And in those 9.5 years, and with children, sometime in the middle of the night, in many ways I felt safer there than I feel in some of our cities here in America. And we got guns. We every day we have more guns. So I'm not sure guns is the answer. How about if we let everybody carry a gun in the Tiger Stadium? How would that be? Because there's some extremists among us who think you ought to be able to carry a gun in the Target. I mean, we've got to come and find what is an acceptable spot that people can be able to practice what is given to them in the law, the Second Amendment, and then what is reasonable in the society. And I think the politicians stay away from that, but it's going to have to be a political issue that we're going to have to address, because what you see happening now is people want to exercise that up to the law. Under their rules, somebody could come in here and be interviewed, Jim, with a long gun.
Mm-hmm. That's
set
true.
Down right here, because the law allows that to happen. But was that the intent of the law is the question.
297-5633. David writes, isn't the overreaction of the police forces in this country partly a response to the increase in private weapon sales, including the spread of assault weapons since the ban was lifted? An expansion of the discussion we're having, but police have a realistic fear of what might occur?
Well, yeah, I think that. But both of these young men that sparked this thing this week, now because we're saying both, we have one. Neither one of them had a gun on them. During the demonstration, each time the people demonstrate, the first day was ridiculous. The police showed up with an MRAP or a reinforced armored vehicle with a man on the top with a scope looking into the crowd as though he was about to shoot somebody. I mean, we don't point weapons at our citizens. I mean, it is ridiculous. So we're 2-0. Two dead, neither one of them with a gun, both dead. I do think we got to retrain our police. There are techniques for dealing with people with knives. There are techniques for dealing with people who are aggressive. And I would like to see how many hours of mixed or martial arts training these police take a year to be able to handle somebody who's out of control without pulling the gun out and shooting them. That comes from strength training. It comes from agility training. It's coming from repetitive. You've got to do, just a quick note, I had one of my MPs in Korea. Somebody took his baton. For 6 months, my police went to 6 hours of then taekwondo training a week. That is martial arts training. Never again would anybody take a baton from one of my police. 6 hours a week. How many hours a week these police have been training?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody want to pay for it. You understand? Nobody want to pay for it. They've got to be trained, and they can learn something from the London police. They can learn something from the French police. And we can learn something from the South Korean police on how you handle crowd. We have not mastered the art of policing because our solution is a gun.
Did you have martial arts training?
Yes. I'm a orange belt taekwondo, which is about two steps from nothing.
Oh, well, are you sending me a message? 297-5633, another topic and a serious one. Today's top story in the New York Times. Kneeling in the dirt in a desert somewhere in the Middle East, James Foley lost his life at the hands of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Before pulling out the knife, his masked executioner explained that he was killing the 40-year-old American journalist in retaliation for recent U.S. airstrikes against the terror group in Iraq. The United States, unlike other foreign countries, has declined to pay ransom for people in the kind of precarious situation that Mr. Foley was in. Should the U.S. have paid a ransom note in this case?
I think our policy has been clear. We will not negotiate with them. And then on occasion we do it. Having been on Joint Chiefs of Staff and sat in the National Security Council, things happen. But our official policy is we do not negotiate with terrorists. But we're in the 21st century. I mean, what these ISIS people, we're not going to get along with them. There's no future alliance where we will get along with them about anything. And we're going to have to continue to apply military as well as economic pressure, controlling where to get their money. And we're going to have to continue to take this formation down. And I do think we can be very effective with our special operating forces, but the special operating force from England, the United States, and all our allies in the region. Special operating forces. I've said from day one when Anderson Cooper got on television and pronounced that these guys had captured the area between Syria and Baghdad. And back then they had 8,000 troops. I said they might capture, but they can't hold it. You cannot defend an area that size with 8,000 people. Now they got 10,000. They are very fragile. We've got to go after them, and we've got to use our strength against them. And our strength is firepower. And how we fly that plow plow, let special operating forces from with all our allies get in there and get after them, and we could take these guys down.
Joanne in New Roads. Joanne, good morning. You're on with General Russell Honoré.
Thank you for taking my call. I know you switched subjects, but by the time I call, you had switched. I just wanted to agree with the general that it probably is a good thing for police officers to be taught in some type of mechanism to deal with people that are breaking the law other than pulling a gun. And I think that that's going to have to begin with physical fitness, particularly local police. I see more local police that can't walk real fast, much less run, or do physical martial arts. I just think that they maybe need, at the local level, more rigid physical requirements. Thank you.
General?
I agree.
Now, you find all kinds of, there's some police officers who are in very good shape, and
absolutely,
others who are not. I don't know what kind of standards are in place.
I don't know. I was involved when we did the selection for police chief here in Baton Rouge, and I've got to say all those that came up for interview, they look fit. And but that's not, I think, the experience that most of us look. You see exceptions to that mm-hmm. they don't look fit. And if you're not fit, you're more apt to use that gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're talking about for chief.
I'm talking about the run-of-the-mill policemen. Many of them don't look fit. And if you're not fit, you're more apt to pull that gun, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
But you got to be fit to fight. You've got to have hand-to-hand mm-hmm. combat skills.
But the chief should be fit, too.
Our chief, he looks great. I saw him last week. Our city policeman, he's tight. You can mm-hmm. tell he's spending his time in the gym.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that should be, we elect a sheriff. Maybe that should be part of the race, is that they actually get out and do a PT test.
Well, I think they do. Required to do some type of PT test.
Well, let's say if Sid Gautreaux's opposed in his next election, let's see who's better.
Jim, you're getting me off on something here. No. I state the point. If you're fit and you have skills, martial arts skills, combatives is what we call in the Army, and we spend a lot of time with that. We've seen the value of that in our Army. The Trojans are required to do combatives. The Marines started it. They reinvigorated it. When I was a division commander in Korea, my troops had to do 2 to 5 hours of combatives as well as taekwondo weekly.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's great. I love that. I love that. In fact, I think lawmakers should be required to have PT tests.
Well, it might be an alternative that wanted to carry guns in the Capitol. That was unbelievable. Now they're putting a fence up around the Capitol, putting the elephant fence around it. That's going to look good.
Yeah, that'll be an aesthetic beauty.
Oh, that's really nice. We don't have one on the nation's Capitol, but we're going to have one in Louisiana.
Well, 297-5633, 877-217-5757, a man who walks the walk and talks the talk, General Russell Honoré, will be with us for a few more minutes, and then we'll hear from Gwen Rowland of the Atchafalaya Houseboat, and we'll talk with General Honoré about the Green Army, which he led at the Capitol over the last few months, and how the Green Army is still involved in Louisiana politics, despite taking it on the chin a few times in the last session. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. A few more minutes with General Russell Honoré. The General is, along with several environmental groups, calling for strengthening EPA's proposed refinery pollution standards. Why so?
Well, the facts show that people that near plants, particularly refineries and the power generation that run off of coal, that put large amount of carbon into the air, having a health effect on the people that live in that area. Documented fact. We want the EPA, if you look at this law they've come up with, it gives the impression that the government's doing its job, and they're not. Because it's only a step toward correcting the problem we have with the amount of pollution that's going into the air. We are pressing the EPA to modernize the monitoring of the plants using 21st century technology. We proposed that in the Louisiana legislature that we adopt 21st century technology, meaning that we would have sensors in and around the plant, on the fence line, and in the fence line communities, as we call them. We were making some progress in committee on that until our senator up from Shreveport area asked the Louisiana DEQ person, do we need what I was describing or what the Green Army was describing? And our own DEQ person said, no, we don't need that. Now, the DEQ, that's the people that work for us in the state that's supposed to monitor air quality, said we don't need it. It would cost the companies money. That is what the state employees say. Well, yes, it will cost some money, but it's for our safety that we would have modern equipment that could give you a message on your smartphone that tell you, hey, there's a release in the area. Go to shelter because you're inside the area. That's what I'm talking about, a black box in the plants that if there's a disaster, think about if we had a black box on the BP oil rig that would have told us all the conversations that went on before the accident happened, what was happening during the accident. We could reconstruct that and try to make future drilling into the Gulf safer. But what happened when we tried to reconstruct the story? Everybody got their lawyer and said, I will not answer that because it might incriminate me. We can't afford another BP in the Gulf. And the issue with this new EPA rule is we're putting it out as an objective, but we don't have the teeth and we're not applying technology to monitoring, Jim. And I think we owe the people of Louisiana clean air and clean water.
All right. Sonia in Lafayette, you're on the air with General Honoré. Good morning, Sonia.
Hi, good morning. Actually, the topic has changed, but I just had a question for the general. Thank you so much for your service to us also. Do you feel it was really necessary in Ferguson for the National Guard to be called out? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
All right, that's a good question.
The National Guard is there for at the disposal of the governor. And the role they're doing is a mission that they have to be prepared for their governor to deal with civil disturbance. It's one of the reasons we have National Guard in each state. We see them call out often to deal with storms and flooding and fires. But the reason we had the National Guard in the state under the control of the governor is to be able to be used for incidents like this, civil disturbance. And I think the manner in which these guardsmen have been used, they're using them in a support role to help secure the police areas of operation. That the mission in Ferguson is more appropriate for police, and they're using police. But our guard are well trained, they're well equipped, and I've got the full confidence that our National Guard will do the right thing.
All right, Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on with General Honoré. Charles, hello.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, General. And I hope one day you will be the president of my Southern University. But the reason I'm calling this morning is, I would like your opinion on the possible hundreds of BPs that could occur in Louisiana from fracking. Most people don't know the EPA can't even get these companies to reveal the formula in these fracking fluids, and I'm afraid eventually they're going to contaminate our groundwater. I'd like to hear your comment on it.
Well, on the concept of fracking is allowed by the federal government. I do think it's a fool's gold. Because of the impact it has on our water and on our environment. And as soon as I say that, all of the lobbyists will be lighting up the phones saying, I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's proven that fracking has a bad effect on the environment. It kills water and it destroys communities when it comes to the environment, and it releases large amount of benzene into the air, and it's not healthy to be around. And if we're going to do it, we need to do it in areas that are sparsely populated and not places like St. Tammany with high population density. If you're going to do it, and don't put the fracking water back into the ground. It should be made to clean the fracking water. Remember, the state of Louisiana give them exemptions on fracking, on a tax exemption for several years, 3 years, when you open a frack. The federal government give them federal tax exemption. So they're making straight up money when they take that stuff out of the ground. The state of Louisiana have to have a law that declares fracking water toxic. Right now, the state of Louisiana does not classify fracking water, but if you put it on a plant, it'll kill it. If you drink it, it'll kill you, as toxic. So it's allowed to be put back in abandoned wells in Louisiana, just like it's being put in Homer right now.
Final question for General Honore John in Lafayette. John, good morning. You're on with the General.
Good morning, General. You have the respect of our state and our nation and for all the good things you've done for both of us. General, what about the legislature? They're up for a re-election next year. Is the Green Army going to be involved in the election of the legislators who voted to release the All Comers from responsibility for the damage done to the marsh?
Thanks, Jared. Next Saturday in New Orleans, we're going to have a breakfast at Xavier University, day after Katrina, and the Green Army will have a conversation. We'll have it online, I'm pretty sure, where you can see it and listen. We will release our legislative scorecard to inform the people of Louisiana, how did your legislators vote on those issues associated with fighting pollution? And certainly we declare the one dealing with holding them accountable for closing those canals has attributed to the damage to our marsh area by allowing saltwater intrusion. Mm-hmm. So we will do that next week, but we're not a political organization. We're going to tell you what they did and who voted with us and who voted against us. And then, but we're not going to take a campaign out to go after politicians. There are other groups that do that. We are fighting pollution. The politicians just happen to be in the way.
Well, General, it is a distinct honor and pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we have occasion to do so again. Thanks for your service to our country and for giving us a few hours of good radio over the last several years.
Peace.
Peace. And love. And we're joined now by Gwen Rowland, the author of The Atchafalaya Houseboat and the star of the award-winning Louisiana Public Broadcasting documentary of the same name. She is in town today. And good morning to you, Gwen.
Good morning, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you and your companion, Calvin, left the city in 1973 to live on a houseboat that you built by hand. Not a conventional way of life, but something that you and Calvin were comfortable with.
That's right. You know, so much of what the General was just saying went home for me, because Calvin and I were part of that generation that had that gut feeling that as things were changing so quickly from the way our own fathers and grandfathers had raised their food, that something was not quite right. We didn't have that many resources yet to for information to fall back on. We had Rachel Carson. We had the Rodale publications, Organic Gardening and Prevention. Mother Earth was just getting cranked up in the early 70s. So there wasn't a lot of scientific backing yet, but we felt that there were better, healthier ways to raise our food. And that's basically what we were doing, going back to our grandparents' way of living. We planted fish in our garden, fish guts and fish that died in our nets for our fertilizer, and used chickens for insect control, that sort of thing. And now it's good to see two generations coming behind us that have taken that all the way into now it's a whole government-sanctioned movement to be growing food in a more humane way.
Now, this happened in 1973, and then 30 years later, you and Calvin reunited for the documentary produced by LPB that has been aired on PBS stations around the country. How did this process evolve?
The credit for that goes to the producer, Christina Melton. I think she said she ducked into a bookstore here in Baton Rouge during a rainstorm and just happened to see that beautiful cover by C.C. Lockwood, and picked it up, started thumbing through it, and said to herself, this is the subject I've been looking for a documentary told only in the subject's voice. It was a project she just had had in mind, and she hadn't seen me or heard me, but something about the book spoke to her that I would be the right person to for her to use for this.
And the response was overwhelming.
It really has been. Now through things like Facebook and email, strangers find me, and I still live quite like I did in the documentary. I don't have to haul everything by boat anymore, but I pretty much grow my own food and spend most of my time in the woods out there on our in our little cottage and our gardens. But people find me, and I can always tell where the documentary is showing because I suddenly start getting emails from Ohio or Oregon or sometimes even Canada. So it's really touched a lot of people. I think just the sheer beauty of it does.
And you mentioned C.C. Lockwood. He caught the essence of what you were doing so many years ago.
He did. If it hadn't been for him, Calvin and I would have just said so many times to each other, somebody ought to take pictures of this place, which is what we used to say all the time back when no one even knew about the Atchafalaya except the people who lived around it. And if C.C. hadn't dropped in on us and taken the pictures, lots of things would not have happened, as you know, not just for Calvin and me, but for the basin itself and for Louisiana.
We're visiting with Gwen Rowland, the author of Atchafalaya House Book from LSU Press. The documentary based on Gwen's book was produced by Louisiana Public Broadcasting in 2008, and most PBS stations air it about twice a year. You are in Baton Rouge today. What's going on as we speak?
I'll be heading out to meet with some friends from the LSU Press that worked on with my book, Atchafalaya Houseboat. And then I think I'm going to drop by a bookstore today and just sign the stock that they have in. And we'll be going to the station tonight, I think, to sign books that will be given away as part of the pledge drive. And I will be having the pleasure at 65 years old watching the 58-year-old me talk about the 20-something-year-old me in the documentary. So I'm just hoping I can hold it all together and keep my head from spinning too much.
Well, Gwen's first article for Mother Earth News was published in 1982. I think you were about 32 or 33 at the time. And Barge on the Bayou described the details of building a monstrous floating house without power tools. So you've been doing this kind of thing for a while, haven't you?
I have. I've always been a person that just liked to do physical things with my hands. And the satisfaction that you get from building something or repairing something yourself is something I always encourage other people to try. It's very pleasurable. I've always preferred to, say, spend all day making something or 2 days or a week than to work 2 hours for money to pay for one made by somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Lately, you've been writing about your love of animals.
That's right. After a career of writing about sustainable agriculture, I retired in 2010 and took up the cause of abandoned animals in our rural county in Georgia. We don't have an animal control shelter or even any regulations, and we have a long culture of not spaying and neutering pets. So I think a lot of people in Louisiana can relate to a county that has a lot of abandoned litters on the side of the road, and that's something I work toward. We help bring some low-cost spay-neuter options to the county. We try to raise awareness through stories and publicizing dogs that we rescue. I'm a foster family for a private rescue organization in our county. And I'm on my 40th foster dog, and
it's a
great pleasure every time one's adopted, and then I can bring another one in.
Hilda on Partridge writes, living in the swamps, how did you handle the mosquitoes?
You know, I just don't remember them being that bad, Hilda. When we went out there for the filming in 2007 or 8, the mosquitoes were just terrible. There were more of them, and the stings hurt more. And both Calvin and CC told me that it's a new breed of mosquito that came in from Texas or something. But had they been that bad in the 1970s, I don't know how we would have lived. But as it was, I only remember we stayed out of the woods around dusk in the springtime. And that, other than the mosquito netting over our bed, was our only concern with the mosquitoes.
Well, thank you so much, Gwen Rowland, the author of The Atchafalaya Houseboat, and the LPB documentary is based on Gwen's book. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.